From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the suburbs. If you live in the suburbs, are you happy? Do you want to see changes? President Trump has been warning that for wealthy suburbanites, the threat of low-income neighbors is coming. Trump has vowed to protect wealthy subdivisions. Last month, he wrote, quote, "People living their suburban lifestyle dream would no longer be bothered or financially hurt by having low-income housing built in your neighborhood," end quote. On Wednesday, the president tweeted, quote, "The suburban housewife will be voting for me. They want safety and are thrilled that I ended the long-running program where low-income housing would invade their neighborhood. Biden would reinstall it in a bigger form with Cory Booker in charge," end quote. Cory Booker himself responded by saying, quote, "President Trump, your racism is showing," end quote. Now, Trump had made similar remarks last week. When asked about his move to repeal a fair housing rule, President Trump warned that low-income housing was threatening to destroy suburbia. He said Joe Biden is going to expand low-income housing, leading to an invasion, and the president was referring to his administration's decision last week to roll back an Obama-era program intended to combat racial segregation in suburban housing. The program expanded provisions in the Fair Housing Act to encourage diversification and foster inclusive communities. For President Trump, the phrase inclusive communities is synonymous with crime and falling home values. He's making a play for white votes during an election year. As Joel Kotkin of Forbes recently noted, Trump won suburbia by a significant 5 percentage point margin nationally in 2016. That was an improvement on Mitt Romney's 2-point win in the suburbs in 2012. Kotkin writes, quote, "The suburbs drive the swing states. Suburban voters particularly put Trump ahead in the crucial Midwestern states of Michigan, Wisconsin, and came close to winning him supposedly deep blue Minnesota," end quote. And why would Trump talk about suburban housewives in particular? Because white women are key to his reelection. According to heavily debated exit polls in 2016, 53% of white women voted for Trump. The core of that white women's support is the suburbs. This hour, we're talking to suburban leaders about this issue, low income and affordable housing, racism, and what kind of growth suburbs should welcome. Our guests this hour include three town supervisors. The supervisor of the town of Henrietta is Steve Schultz. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
The town of Brighton supervisor, Bill Maley, is with us. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
Good. And supervisor of the town of Irondequoit, Dave Seeley, is with us. Hi, Dave.
Good afternoon, Evan.
Well, all of our guests this hour happen to be Democrats. We reached out to numerous Republican town supervisors. Here are some of the results. Bill Rylick, supervisor of the town of Greece, did not respond to our invitation. Tony LaFountain, supervisor of the town of Penfield, also did not respond. Bill Smith, supervisor of the town of Pittsford, sent us the following note. He writes, quote, "I'll decline because I don't think I'd have anything to contribute beyond stating my belief that what gets built in a community should be decided by the people of that community and not in Washington," end quote. So we've got three supervisors, and I'll start just by asking you to respond to what the president has been saying about the suburbs, protecting suburban housewives, an invasion of low-income housing, and more. Steve Schultz, I'll start with you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, quite frankly, it disgusts me because he's gone beyond dog whistles and is essentially, you know, making racist statements and campaigning on it, essentially. And, you know, even if you take the racism out of it, there's classism because he basically says, well, if they're poor, there must be a lot of crime, right? The racism, when you tie it back to the Fair Housing Act, which was specifically put in place to protect against racist policies with regards to housing, there's no question what this is. And you know, Henrietta is a town that is quite diverse and shows that his contentions are false. So I'll stop there and give my colleagues a chance to respond.
Well, let me just follow up with one point there. Do you think the wealthier residents of Henrietta would agree with the president and that would the wealthier residents of Henrietta want to see a limit on low-income housing?
I couldn't tell you. I would never want to speak for my residents. I will just say that I've never heard any resident complain in any way, shape, or form about the wage level or race of our other residents. So I've not heard that complaint in the 2.5 years I've been here. So
okay.
That would lead me to say no, but again, I can't speak for my residents.
Okay. Bill Maley, supervisor of the town of Brighton, what was your response to the remarks from the president?
Well, I was terribly offended. I certainly agree with Supervisor Schultz. They were racist. They were offensive at many levels. And I chose to write a letter to the president, which I also posted on my own social media, noting that Brighton is a diverse community. We have worked in many ways to try to foster affordable housing in a diverse community. We were the third community in upstate New York to pass a law prohibiting discrimination against renters based on the source of income. What I learned, frankly, I was surprised several years ago to learn that New York State did not prohibit that kind of discrimination. And I was hearing anecdotally that folks using Section 8 housing vouchers were having trouble finding good, safe rental units. So that's one of the things we did. We are a community with many faith traditions, many racial and ethnic backgrounds, and that diversity makes us stronger. So I just couldn't disagree with the president more. I am just terribly offended, and I think the people of Brighton overwhelmingly would agree with that.
And just to follow up for you, Supervisor Maley, do you agree with the president's contention that most Americans spend their lives trying to work their way up to being able to live in the suburbs?
No, I don't. I think we've seen demographic studies that have shown actually in recent years, younger generations are actually finding urban living to be very attractive. As I look at a community like Brighton, we are an inner ring suburb. We have elements of an urban lifestyle as well as a suburban lifestyle. We're a walkable community. We're a diverse community. We have great schools. I think we are the example of how you can have a diverse community, approximately in the Brighton Central School District. Close to 30% of the school population is non-white. So the notion that diversifying, whether you're talking by race or by income, is going to hurt your schools, that's nonsense. We have terrific schools in Brighton. We have terrific neighborhoods in Brighton. And we have a terrific, diverse population.
Supervisor Dave Seeley speaking in West Texas last week. Here's another one of the quotes from the president about the suburbs. He said, quote, "People fight all of their lives to get into the suburbs and have a beautiful home. There will be no more low-income housing forced into your suburbs. It's been hell for suburbia, but do not worry. Enjoy your lives, ladies and gentlemen," end quote. Has it been hell for suburbia, Supervisor Seeley?
Well, first of all, Donald Trump commenting on what suburban lifestyle is like is akin to me commenting on what it's like to be a member at Mar-a-Lago. I don't think he has any idea what it's like to live in a suburb, so frankly, he really should reserve judgment on making generalities like that. Frankly, he's wrong, and Irondequoit really is, I think, a community locally that has probably the most recent experience with expanding our low and moderate income housing portfolio. We passed a comprehensive plan in 2014 that, in addition to saying we needed a diversity of incomes throughout our neighborhood, also said we needed to revitalize our vacant spaces with housing, multi-dwelling housing, frankly, because we don't have a lot of developable land in Irondequoit. So over the past several years, we've made some very bold zoning changes and decisions that have cited and sourced and approved and paved the way for some of these what you would call lower moderate income housing developments. And I noted after he sent that out that our property values in Irondequoit have increased 35% to 40% in the past several years. There's absolutely no proof that it has a detrimental impact, correlative to lowering property values, et cetera. In most cases, these developments are taking a blighted, at least in our town, are taking a blighted or vacant parcel of land and making them beautiful and allowing people to have access to quality housing. What he doesn't understand and what I want people to understand is, you know, in my town particularly, we have people who would constitute, you know, the working poor. They're the people who work in our hospitals. They're the people who, for the past several months, frankly, have been the ones risking their lives to make sure we can stay safe and go along with our daily lives. The percentage those people have to pay on housing is far greater than it would be if you're making more income. So therefore, the goal is to ensure that someone can have access to quality housing while not spending 40-50% of their income on that housing. So to his point, if you're talking about the dream of home ownership and living in suburbia, how about the dream of just everyone in America having access to quality housing that doesn't constitute an economic harm and taking up a certain portion of their income? So he's racist on this, and he's wrong.
You're hearing Dave Seeley, supervisor of the town of Irondequoit. Also with us, Bill Maley, supervisor of the town of Brighton. Steve Schultz, supervisor of the town of Henrietta. We're talking about President Trump's remarks about the suburbs and his contention that he is the candidate to protect the suburbs from an invasion of low-income housing, crime, and falling market values. I want to listen to some of what the president said. I'll also invite listeners to call the program if you want to share your experiences, your thoughts, whether you live in the suburbs or not. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. The president was questioned about this yesterday during his daily news conference. He's been holding a number of those lately. And let's listen to that exchange now.
You have sworn several times that if Joe Biden is elected president, that there will be an invasion in suburban neighborhoods. It's a sentiment that you expressed in a tweet again this morning. What exactly do you mean by invasion?
What I mean is people are going to become, they're going to be opening up areas of your neighborhood, which they're doing, and now they're going to do, they wanted to expand it, and they will expand it. If for any reason, they're going to, in my opinion, destroy suburbia. And just so you understand, 30% plus of the people living in suburbia are minorities. African American, Asian American, Hispanic American, they're minorities. 30%. The number's even higher. They say 35, but I like to cut it a little bit lower. You know why? That way I can never get myself in too much trouble with the fake news. But 30% plus are minorities living in suburbia. And when they go in and they want to change zoning so that you have lots of problems where they want to build low-income housing. You want something where people can aspire to be there, not something where it gets hurt badly. And that's what happens. So with suburban women, suburban men, I think they feel very strongly about what I'm doing. It's a very fair question. It's a very important question. But they fought all their lives to be there, and then all of a sudden they have something happen that changes their life and changes what they fought for so many years.
That's President Trump just yesterday defending his remarks, saying that they're not based on race. They're based on making sure people are protected, that their dreams are protected. Steve Schultz, does that change the way you view it? Does that sort of, mollify some of your concerns about the president's remarks recently?
Not in the least. You know, basically, again, he's saying, so if you make less money, you are a criminal. Work all your dream to get in the suburbs. I know I was born in a suburb. The whole concept to me, again, it's the, there goes the neighborhood, right? That's what he's basically saying. We let these people in and there goes the neighborhood. And, you know, that's just, it's wrong on so many levels. It's hard to know where to begin. It doesn't change my mind at all.
Supervisor Maley, did that exonerate him in your view in any way? Hey there, Bill. Off mute, if you could. There you are. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. It reinforced. I mean, the number of times he said it or they, whoever they are. He's appealing, it seems to me, to the people with a fear of the unknown, and so much of the anger and hate that we do unfortunately see is based on that fear of the unknown. And in fact, the opportunity to live in a community where you have neighbors of different faith traditions, different gender orientations, different income levels, you get to engage with people. You build a richer environment for yourself and for your children. I just think he's so off base. His racism, and certainly as Supervisor Seeley said, based on his life experiences, he knows nothing about life in the suburbs.
Well, but briefly, Supervisor Maley, he won the suburban vote in 2016, and he would say he does know something about what they want, considering he won that vote.
I don't believe that'll happen again. But I don't look at this. You know, this is more than just political. I mean, because what he's doing is appealing to people's baser sense. I'm not even convinced he really thinks he's appealing to suburban voters. I mean, because you know the very derogatory term suburban housewife. I mean, he manages to throw two stones with that one. You know, he's hearkening back to a time that doesn't exist anymore. It demonstrates that he's really lost touch with the reality of life today. But the demeaning references to housewives and to those people and it's so very problematic and so out of touch with communities like Brighton, like Henrietta, like Irondequoit, and like other suburban communities in the Rochester area.
All right. Well, Supervisor Seeley, I'm going to assume that you also were not swayed by the president's remarks, so I will ask you, why do you think he won the suburban vote in 2016?
Why did he... Look, there's a host of factors. I don't think it was because people in suburban United States were worried about income and racial diversity in their neighborhoods. I think there were a host of other factors, and I don't think you can necessarily pinpoint it on one. Frankly, if he thinks that's his path to winning suburban voters again in 2020, I think he's grossly making a gross miscalculation of kind of where we are as a country. You know, we just last week, I think it was, a local organization issued a report on some of the, you know, racial covenants that have really left a black eye and a dark legacy on racial covenants on home ownership in our communities. And Irondequoit was one in particular that, you know, it's part of our legacy we struggle with. Where as recently as the 40s and 50s, you know, there were these covenants put in that said only white people could live in a home. And I think this is really the modern day version of that, and it's those not even dog whistles anymore. As Supervisor Schultz said, it's just being pretty much outright and emissive of it. And you know, I think it was men like Donald Trump back in the 30s and 40s who were instituting these covenants and trying to keep neighborhoods all white. And it's a shame that the president of the United States in 2020. Really isn't any different than the people who were putting those covenants in place. So it really is a shame. I think the character of America, as Vice President Biden says, the soul of America, hopefully will win the day in this. And I think we're hopefully as a country, you know, we're going to show that this is not how we feel. This is not these sort of threats to our existence and safety. Are not resounding, and we don't believe them and not believable. So I do not think this is a accurate path to victory for him for 2020. So if that's how he thinks he's going to prevail in the suburbs again, he better find a different route.
Let me get some of your phone calls and feedback in for three different town supervisors responding to the president's remarks in the last few weeks about American suburbs. Leslie in Rochester first. Hi, Leslie. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you for this conversation today. It's vitally important to all communities. I just want to share a little tidbit about my history. I was born in an urban city here in Rochester, yay, Rochester, and was our family moved to the suburbs when there was that opportunity, yet myself and my brothers were fortunate to be able to continue our education in the city school district. I still remain in Rochester, and I did leave for a period of time and went abroad. Upon coming back with my two Italian-born children, it was very, very shocking to return to my suburban environment and to witness just how little it had changed from when I had left. And I'm talking late 70s, early 80s, to the point where my daughter, age 4 and a half, said, "Mommy, I do not like where we're living." "Why?" You know, thinking, you know, it's hard, not making new friends, all of the, you know, different language, all of those types of obstacles was what she was talking about. When we got down to it, she said, "It is too white. There isn't anybody that looks like me. I don't want to live here." And we're talking about a local suburban, you know, area, the neighborhood, basically, where I grew up. So here we are, 2020, and to be having this discussion, knowing that many suburbs have done such great work to diversify both socially, ethnically, socioeconomically, their areas for the words of Mr. Trump to be said is absolutely disgusting. And I applaud all of those town supervisors that are working diligently to fight back and continue the fight for healthier housing, healthier communities. And that's it.
Leslie, thank you for your phone call. I appreciate that. And before I turn to the supervisors, maybe to respond to some of that, let me also just ask them if they could clarify. You can follow up on what Leslie said, and also Gary sent just a note saying, could some of your guests define the difference between, quote, low-income housing versus, quote, affordable housing, end quote. Supervisor Schultz, can you fill in on that?
So I'm the political rookie, if you will. So I don't know that I could fully define that, other than, you know, we work with developers. You know, one of the things that you find a lot of developers want to do, they want to build only the real high-end houses because they can make larger margins off of that typically. But, you know, we encourage them to build houses that, you know, are more the starter houses, the more affordable, as well as, you know, we have some projects in town that, you know, like Heritage Gables, Heritage Gardens, where they there is some state assistance to help people, you know, to I think it was Dave Seeley's point, where, you know, if it's such a huge portion of their income, you know, that the rent is based off of the area mean income, that if they're below that, the rent drops. So it's a mix of things. I couldn't, again, I don't really care about labeling things. Mm-hmm. I just know that you want people to be able to afford their house and not go broke trying to get into their house. And so, you know, the thing I love about here, and following up on what the caller just said, you know, when I grew up, all my friends were white. Why? Because that's where I grew up. I grew up in Tonawanda. My graduating senior class of over 600 kids, there were 3 black kids. That was it in the entire class. Oh, I love seeing how my kids, their friends, you know, essentially all shades from light to dark and everything in between, they don't think about race, right? You want to end racism, that's where you got to get to, right? My son doesn't have black friends. He has friends. Some of them happen to have black skin, right? That's where we've got to get to, in this idea that we're going to protect the neighbor or the suburbs to you know, from these invasions. I mean, that's just deplorable. It really is. Hmm.
Bill Maley, affordable versus low income. Is there a definition in your mind there?
Well, I think low income has been a long time pejorative term that's been used by critics. I really think affordability, which, as Supervisor Schultz mentioned, is typically based on a threshold, a percentage of income levels for a family of a given size in an area. You know, we had a project here in Brighton, the Deerfield Woods project, that was a little different because it was owner-occupied. They were purchased homes and had outside subsidy benefits that made it economically viable. That's a wonderful neighborhood today. Our hope was that that people who are providing essential services would find it a good home, and it has been that. I think that that diversity that affordable housing brings is so valuable to a community, and it has worked, and it will continue to work. But it's important because affordable housing today continues to be supported by the federal government because it can be economically difficult for a developer. We have some great developers here in the Rochester area who focus on affordable housing, but they're able to do that because of some of the tax-based and other federal programs that do make it economically viable. So when a president makes promises about cutting back on those programs, what he's really doing is, like he wants to do with seemingly everywhere he goes, he's just trying to build another wall. We don't need walls. We need bridges.
Supervisor Seeley, you want to add to that?
So on the definition, generally, government subsidized housing is for families between what's known as 30 to 80% of the area median income level. So that's semantics. So our median family income in this region is $76,000, I believe. So it would be anywhere between those thresholds. So that's really the legal HUD definition. I think affordable is generally implies just a broader, more aspirational term. I'll just say this. Rondaquoit, to Leslie's point, Rondaquoit is a town that, in the 20 years since I graduated from high school, has grown considerably more diverse, and that's a good thing, to the extent that I think in the next census will be anywhere between a fifth and a quarter persons of color living in Rondaquoit. And you see that throughout our neighborhoods, and I think that has had nothing but a positive impact on our community. With regards to providing affordable housing for residents, I think, this is where local leaders at the town level really are the most important people. By and large, what the president is doing is try to instill fear and through messaging, but I think the local leaders are still the ones who are empowered by this, and I think we need to really be the ones to look to take bold action and stand up against matters like this. Just right now, actually, we have an application to redevelop a vacant property into about 100 units that are targeted specifically for healthcare workers, many of whom in the entry level do constitute the working poor. So again, it's a statement of values at the local level. These people, by and large, live in our community. We have a large presence of Rochester Regional Health in our community. They're the ones keeping us safe, risking their lives. So they come into our community work, and is it then we just tell them, okay, go back to another community to live your life? I think it's only you want people of all income levels, of all races, if they're working in your community, to be living there as well. So it really, it really is up to local leaders to make a stand. And diversity can happen organically, but as we've seen, there's a lot of barriers to diversity in diverse communities, and I think we need to do what we can to perpetuate it at the local level as well. So, actions speak louder than words, I think, and we really need to adhere to that and stand up against what the president is doing.
Three town supervisors with us on the line today: Dave Seeley from the town of Rondaquoit, Steve Schultz from the town of Henrietta, Bill Maley from the town of Brighton, responding to President Trump's comments about, in the president's words, protecting American suburbs and in particular suburban housewives from invasion of low-income housing that he says would happen if he's not president. So we're talking about that, and we have a lot of phone calls and emails, and if you're on the phone We're going to try to take our only break and then squeeze in as many great calls as we can, because there's a lot of really interesting perspectives to share. So if you've called or emailed, hang in there. This is our only break, and we're right back to you next. Coming up in our second hour, Black Women's Equal Pay Day marks a year in which most of the events we're going to see with this campaign have moved online. So how to reach people? And really, is this event about empowering individuals to negotiate better? Or does it start at the top? Why is there such a disparity in pay? We examine all of those issues next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me get Corey in Rochester next. Go ahead, Corey.
Hi, good afternoon. So I want to question the existence of the town of Parrington. And I ask that because it's kind of this amoeba that wanders all in between, you know, many different of the suburb towns. And in Fairport, we have the Pines of Parrington, which is technically in Parrington, but it's really in the center of Fairport. And, you know, we had the swastika issue not so long ago, and it was dubbed as in the town of Parrington. And if you've ever driven around the Pines of Parrington, it is really scary and painfully obvious that when it was built, they did everything in their power to hide it and to keep the rest of Fairport from being blighted by an eyesore. And I just wonder how many of these low-income housing projects and places are located in the town of Parrington that, you know, that was done purposely sort of to hide them and keep them out of the limelight.
You're saying the town of Parrington is like sort of a place to launder low-income housing?
Well, not necessarily launder it, but if you think about, you know, Parrington, it's not like a Fairport or a Pittsford. You know, there's no town of, you know, there's no center. It just meanders all around. And the Pines of Parrington is one example that is in Parrington, even though really, I mean, everyone considers
okay.
it Fairport.
Well, so let me just jump in. Yeah, let me just jump in, Corey, and say that, you know, first of all, I think Route 31, there's a lot going on at the Parrington Wegmans and in that area. I mean, it's very plaza-y, and if that's your thing, there's a lot there on Route 31, and that's Parrington, as far as I know. And because we don't have representatives of the town of Parrington, I mean, I don't want to pursue this too far here, Corey. I guess I take the point, but what I'm going to do is, instead of kind of trying to litigate what's going on in Parrington, which I don't know if I can be productive with, I'm going to ask our guests a different question. If you could, what I'd like to do is respond to this comment from Stephanie Townsend, who is a member of the town board of Pittsford. She says, "It seems to me that there is not a single answer to make housing in suburban towns more affordable. It will take a mix of strategies. No one development will solve the problem. And I'd like to hear from the supervisors about how they've used a combination of strategies in their towns to diversify housing types in a way that makes housing more affordable. What has been the role of multifamily housing, missing middle housing?" She says bungalow courts, townhomes, duplex, quadplex. "Also mixed-use commercial residential zoning, government or nonprofit-funded developments, community land trusts or land banks. And are there different strategies needed in towns that have higher median incomes and so may not be eligible for all the same federal and state housing grants?" That comes from Stephanie. I'll start with Supervisor Seeley on this one. Go ahead.
Well, thanks to Councilwoman Townsend for the comment. There are a host of strategies. You know, land use really is our most effective tool. Because as a matter of principle, and I'm talking your zoning policy, generally zoning, it can reference matters of income level, but zoning really looks at the actual proposal for housing and the components of that. It's almost blind to the income levels. Now, nothing happens in a vacuum. You certainly are akin and aware of, I think, the type of market that the developer is attracting. But when we look at a development, we look at its impact to the residential area, mainly from a physical point of view. And when we have residents come and say, we don't want low-income housing, well, we certainly disagree with those sort of things. But we also say, really, we're not allowed to make determinations based on the income level of people living there. That's not kind of a loophole for us, but we really do have to look at things from a land use point of view. there are a number of strategies you can apply. You know, we adopted, I said earlier, a comprehensive master plan a few years ago. One of the goals of that was a diversity of housing stock. Believe it or not, Irondequoit, relative to other suburbs, actually has far more single-family homes than other communities. I think we're up near 80% in that regard. Looking to the future, one of the goals we wanted to promulgate was a diversity of housing stock. And frankly, it's given us the opportunity to redevelop a lot of, I don't want to say blighted, but vacant, unused parcels, including the former Irondequoit Mall, including some churches that have become vacant, farmland, et cetera. So it's been a good way for us to reimagine parts of our town, knowing that we're a town that's largely developed, that doesn't have a lot of opportunities for redevelopment, and it's allowed us to reimagine that in a good way while promulgating other goals in concert with that.
Well, and let me just follow up with you there, Supervisor Seeley, before I kick to your colleagues, because we have an email from one of your residents. James says, a note to Supervisor Seeley, the lower-income housing that the supervisor references is distanced from the neighborhoods of single-family homes, having little to no real effect on housing values. And James says, not long ago, a referendum to designate a former church legal for low-income housing was proposed. It was in a neighborhood I once lived in, an amazing place. It faced tremendous opposition from the people in that neighborhood for good reason. These specific low-income housing projects inevitably draw in a criminal element. Just ask the people who have lived around the one in Greece. The elephant in the room is that low-class people, and sometimes criminals, live and congregate in low-income areas, whether it's the city, rural, or suburbs. That's a fact. Calling people racist for stating this is showing your prejudice, Mr. Supervisor. That is from James, one of your residents, Mr. Supervisor. Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to respectfully disagree with James on a number of those contentions and correct him. The project he was talking about was converting a church building into a apartments. It was actually high-end market apartments, so it had nothing to do with the income level of the proposal. The neighborhood sadly just didn't want it, and that's probably one of my biggest regrets, frankly, as being supervisor, and it had nothing to do with providing opportunities for low-income housing. It was a good project that the entire neighborhood simply didn't like, and that's probably one I'll take to the grave is regretting. Now, I'll just say this. The projects we have done, the affordable housing developments, have been fitted right in with the neighborhood. Now, we always look at having factors that provide some separation because you have backyards and, you know, multi-dwelling units. So if it's a fence, it's trees, that's one thing. But we have made sure we've incorporated these housing developments into the neighborhood. Drive down to Seabreeze, you'll see the redevelopment of the former St. Salome's Church in a manner that fits in beautifully with the neighborhood. I think at first the neighbors were concerned about the development, but have actually, since it opened 2 years ago, I've heard no concerns about it. And that's one thing, you know, the point that the caller made about, you know, I don't really know what he was talking about, but about how, you know, you might be tucking away affordable housing. That was the problem. And you saw, that's where you see this notion of the projects. They're all put all the low-income housing in one part of the city or put it all tucked away. That's not what we can do anymore. We need to make sure that we are integrating these projects throughout the community so they're not tucked away in a corner, so you're not having all the consolidation of lower moderate income housing in one part of a municipality. That's not good. I don't think anyone agrees with that. So you do want to find ways to incorporate a diversity of income throughout your community.
Well, I take the point, but it's also sort of been debated in a lot of different quarters in this country in recent years about whether people in the suburbs are on board with what you just said. And, you know, James, who sent the note about the church conversion, might wonder, do you think it should be up to the residents or should it be up to the government? Because you say, Mr. Supervisor, that was a project that you regret not pushing more for, but you also said the people didn't want it. The suburbanites didn't want it. Should it be up to suburbanites, whether low income or let's say affordable housing arrives in their town, perhaps on their street or in their neighborhoods?
Well, when we do rezoning applications, we look primarily at our comprehensive plan. Again, nothing happens in a vacuum. You do want to take residents' concerns. I'll say we're elected representatives of the people. It's our job to listen to the people, but also make determinations that we think are best for the entire town. And that's how I think we look at most issues. And that's how I think we look at when we get these rezoning proposals. We're looking at a variety of factors, how it advances our town, how it helps us accomplish certain goals relative to either our comprehensive plan or other goals that we're trying to make our community better. So I would say, yes, of course, we listen to residents, but no, I don't think a referendum should be held every time there's a proposed development.
Okay. Supervisor Maley, you want to talk about especially responding to Councilmember Townsend's email about the various options you have and also the question of whether it should be up to your residents.
Sure, and I appreciate the councilwoman's comments. Conversely, a little bit to what Supervisor Seeley said, Brighton actually has a relatively high percentage of multifamily or rental units, and with the work that we've done to make sure that landlords cannot discriminate against people who use Section 8 housing vouchers is one way that the market has, it opens up availability for people at different demographic levels. One of the tools that we've used in Brighton is incentive zoning, and we've heard about incentive zoning in the commercial context, but we also have commercial incentive zoning projects that are residential, in some cases senior. And one of the things we have identified affordable housing as a community amenity that we want to encourage developers who use incentive zoning to do. And in fact, if we have incentive zoning residential projects, we do have a mandate that a percentage of the units being developed be affordable. And by doing it that way, we've also accomplished the goal of integrating those affordable units in with a mix of other types of units so they don't stick out, so the people who live in those units are not stigmatized or the units themselves aren't stigmatized. I think it is important that we be creative in identifying ways to bring those housing opportunities into our community. In terms of who decides, we always take a very open process. We do listen to community members, but we also have to listen to the work that community members put in. Just as Supervisor Seeley mentioned, we recently updated our comprehensive plan. That's something we do every 10 years, and that's something we do with a very strong level of community input. And we touch base on the goals and objectives set forth in that comprehensive plan, which are very much community-driven. As we look at future land use, we want to make sure that the vision articulated in that plan is consistent with the approval process for projects as they come in.
All right, Supervisor Schultz, go ahead.
Yeah, a lot of what we do is essentially working with the developers. You know, there's a lot of good developers in town, and they get it. You know, so one of the projects we were just discussing recently, you know, had a good mix of, so it's in one of the planned unit developments in town. Well, actually, our only in Henrietta, it's our only one, but where they were going to have some higher end townhomes or in houses along the essentially a frontage to a golf course. They were going to have some more affordable housing, including a mix of smaller single-family homes and some multi-dwelling units. And then there was going to be what I'll call the middle tier, you know, what most people think of as a suburban home. Or a traditional suburban home, for lack of a better way to put it. So, you know, the developers work along those lines. And again, to my colleague's point, you often need to do some stuff to encourage that. And some of that comes from, you know, again, some of that comes from some of these federal programs, and it's not even just the new stuff. You know, we have a neighborhood in town that all these years later still doesn't have sewer. And so, you know, we have some seniors living there. In fact, the one woman is going to the bathroom in a porta potty because her septic system has failed, and we're able to get a new sewer there through the community development block grant, which comes from from HUD. And that is specifically geared towards helping put in infrastructure in areas that, you know, what most people would consider to be, you know, lower economic value portions of town. So, you know, these programs help build better communities all around. And the idea that, you know, it's destroying the suburbs is so wrong. In fact, again, they're making the suburbs stronger. So, you know, we're able to do things like that. We're able to, you know, we had just done a update to our comprehensive land use plan, and one of the things we put in there is incentives and mixed use options to deal with these areas that were, you know, I'll call them tired retail areas, tired commercial areas, you know, that as some of the brick and mortar stores are going away, you end up with these areas that really can use some redevelopment. So, you know, one of the things that you can do is put in ways to bring in, you know, incentive programs to help developers bring in the type of thing you're looking for there. And so, again, one of those things is, especially as you look at a lot of the current generation, they prefer not to have to use vehicles as much. They'd prefer to, you know, live near where they work. And so we have a mixed-use employment area and a mixed-use redevelopment corridor. And these are, you know, things to try to reuse the existing buildings. You know, we often hear as town supervisors, why did you put that business there? Why didn't you put it over here? Well, that's not our choice. That's the developer's choice. But we can certainly influence where they go with proper zoning and incentive programs and things like that. So that's a lot of what we're trying to do. None of it is what I'll refer to as heavy-handed. We're not saying you have to do this. We're encouraging people to do this. And, again, that's done through incentive programs that maybe get some additional density or, you know, sometimes, again, we were able to get a community development block grant to help defray the cost. There's other different things you can do to help make sure that stuff happen and really improve the overall, not just the appearance of town, but the character of the town. Because, again, the broader the diversity in any decision-making, the more, you know, you don't want to live an insular life. And if you do, then I guess pick a different town than Henrietta. But, you know, it's to me, that's part of our strength, not our weakness.
All right, so let me do this. Every phone line is full, and we're almost to the end of the hour. Let me squeeze in a couple more if I can. John in Rochester next. Go ahead, John.
Thanks, Evan. This is a great show. I think there's a couple points that aren't really being discussed here, and I'll use a real-world example for it. My mother, who is 74 years old and has a housing voucher, lives in a complex, a low-income complex in Webster, New York. She's a 74-year-old white female. She's not exactly the poster child for cultural diversity in Webster, New York, but she qualified for housing there based on her income. My daughter recently graduated from college and, based on her low income, qualified for low-income housing in downtown Rochester in Tower 280. Again, white female from suburbia, not exactly adding to the cultural diversity of that. So when we talk about having low income or affordable housing, I think part of the dirty little secret of that is it's not tied to cultural diversity. And yet we still have people within the city that are struggling to survive every day in very rough neighborhoods that also may qualify if it not be for credit issues or stability and employment. But they're often blocked out or boxed out because somebody else with more knowledge, more information, and better credit can still qualify for the low-income type housing in suburbia. And the only other thing that I would mention is if we look at some of the complexes around the county, particularly the town of Greece has three of them, where they do tend to corral in a lot of lower income residents, and the landowners or developers don't really do anything to maintain these properties. And when you drive through, you see urban blight in suburbia. And that could be causing some of the angst that many people in suburbia may have. So a balance of mixed income housing, but also tying in some sort of cultural diversity to that or ethnic diversity is really what's going to make our towns great. I'll take the feedback off the air.
John, thank you. Down to our last 60 seconds. I'll let Supervisor Maley respond to that and help us close it out. Go ahead, Supervisor Maley.
Well, we absolutely do value cultural diversity in Brighton, and it is a goal, as I said at the start of the show. Our diversity makes us strong, whether it's faith-based, whether it's racial, ethnic. And we're going to continue to work through the many ways that we can do so, and I think with broad community support to make it happen in our town.
Yeah, and I will say, just to John's point about his own family members, I am sensitive, and you're going to hear it next hour, and I am always concerned about understanding and listening as well as I can about issues of diversity, a lot of that centered on race in this country. Maybe too often I leave out conversations about class and economic station, and I think that's certainly valid and important, and maybe left out a little too much here, but I really appreciate the phone call from John, and boy, do I wish we had another hour just for the phone calls. And the emails, my goodness gracious, supervisors, you've lit them up today. So I do hope maybe we can kind of build on this and come back soon. And I'll just say to the supervisor of the town of Henrietta, Steve Schultz, thank you for being generous with your time. Nice having you.
Thank you.
Bill Maley from the town of Brighton. Always good, Bill. Let's talk soon.
I enjoy it. Thanks so much, Evan.
Supervisor Dave Seeley from the town of Irondequoit. Thanks for making it work.
Thanks, Evan. Appreciate it.
All three of you, thank you. And our thanks for all the feedback, listeners. We'll keep at it with these conversations. Too important not to. More connections coming up next.